As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keane, along with Paul Sweeney. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. For this introduction, I need to go to a note which was codified in Market Economics long ago at C.J. Lawrence. You had a headline, and then you had a subhead, and then you had a chart. And it was, of course, the discussion around the chart that led to the invention of modern market economics. And many people would say this began with Ed Hyman at C.J. Lawrence just a few years ago. Ed, let me get to your most recent note, coveted on Wall Street. Remember, folks, we protect the copyright of all of our guests. Get the Ed Hyman note through Evercore ISI. Ed Hyman, we're back in the old normal inflation range. Is it all clear on the Ed Hyman front for Jerome Powell?
I wouldn't say it's all clear, but it's pretty darn clear. It's clear enough for them to continue to pursue the pause. Whether they cut in March is a little early. It might, you'll want to wait another meeting or two. But my strongest conviction is that inflation is slowing and will continue to slow. You have rents, wages, but I don't want to overlook that there are some prices that are going up like crazy. But in general, I think that inflation is coming down. And Tom, as you know, I have a warm spot in my heart for Milton Friedman, and money growth has slowed down. So I'm sort of following his footsteps.
Ed, I'm looking at shelter inflation as a part and parcel of the goofiness of OER. You've always ignored that. You've gone out for granular data and you feature mortgage rates coming down. Is the mortgage rates coming down from 8%, say, is it a linear function or is there a tip point where home building becomes normal again?
It seems to be a tip point somewhere a little bit above 7. Mortgage rates were 8. Maybe a little over 8, and now they're around 7. And all the information that we have shows that housing has bounced back pretty nicely. Even, Tom, we're getting a little bit of an improvement in rents, which surprised me. For 3 weeks, the survey we've done of apartment companies has picked up a little bit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
It's so okay. We allow gasping on the show, Ed Hyman. I'm gasping all the time. Even Lisa gasps when it's okay. You know, just have some tang and move on. Paul,
hey,
save us.
Ed, talk to us about the labor market. I have been so amazed and surprised, pleasantly so, by the strength, the resilience of the U.S. labor market. How do you put that into context with everything else that's going on out there?
Well, the economy is still pretty good, but I'm just telling you what you just told me. It's pretty good because the labor market is still pretty good.
Yep.
In about 25 minutes, we'll get another reading for unemployment claims. But unemployment claims are the government's best economic indicator. And last week, they fell below 200,000. It was just incredible how low they are. And so until the labor market eases up a little bit, the Fed is going to be reluctant to cut rates. I think they'll be happy to be pausing because inflation is coming down. Now there are, I thought you were going to say that you've been surprised at how much wages have slowed given how strong labor markets are.
Right.
But there are some signs that the labor markets are easing up. For example, the Beige Book came out last week. And like some others, it showed some easing in the labor markets. And we survey employment agencies every week, like a Manpower Inc.
Yep.
And they have reported
right.
a clear easing up in the labor market and in wages. And a measure by Indeed, a labor market company,
right.
has showed a wage tracker has come from 5.5 down to 3.5. There's a lot of signs that labor has eased, but not enough. I'm not sure shocked, but I've been surprised. But whatever it is, it's the key.
Yep.
You got to get labor right. to ease up some to get the economy to slow down more than it has.
If you're
now,
just...
employment increases have slowed from about 500,000 a month. They were increasing 500,000 a month. And the past 3 months, they've been about 170. So, you know, it's like, you know, watching a frog cook in a pan. they don't notice it, but I notice it.
Wonderful thought. Ed Hyman with us here, Evercore ISI. We're going to continue. We are commercial free. Don't go away, Ed. We are commercial free across this entire hour. Lucas Shaw to join us on the side of the economic data here, but on YouTube and on CarPlay, we're thrilled to bring you Ed Hyman this morning. Paul Sweeney.
So, Ed, can we officially take, I don't know, for the remainder of 2024, can we take the recession talk off the table? I've had enough of this. How about you?
Well, I probably have been giving you a problem on this, but I don't think so. I appreciate the question, and let me give you my best shot. So the yield curve has worked six times in a row. Every time you've had a recession, the yield curve has been inverted. So I'm just saying that we've had extreme monetary tightening. Now, it's taken 18 months for that to work. So long that by the time you get to like month 14, all you and I want to say is like, get out of here. It's not going to happen. It's different this time. But the yield curve inverted, for example, in the summer of 06. And the recession didn't start until 08,
right.
18 months later. So we still have another 4 months. I don't know if you can stand it.
Right.
But I guess the main thing I'm trying to say from a practical point of view is that I think the economy is in a slowing pattern. I mentioned employment increases slowing. And so I could continue to be part of Tom's thought process. Our company surveys have slowed.
Right.
We survey companies and 0 to 150 is in the middle.
Right.
And the surveys 2 years ago were 61. Right. And last week they were 49.
Okay.
And I want to digress over to your wonderful page in your research note on China. And what Ed Hyman does, folks, and this is textbook Ed Hyman, is he looks at the equity market and all the media overwhelm of the Hang Seng Index, the Hong Kong Index, and the Shanghai Composite. And you bring it right over, Ed Hyman, to the decline in interest rates in China. Are they going to export a new low yield? Are they going to export disinflation and deflation to the United States?
Well, you got me there. I was going in a different direction, but let me explain. Their yields, like you point out, have been making new lows, and that helps explain why U.S. yields have been pretty quiet. It also, the weakness in China has helped explain why commodity prices have been weak. And it's been pretty clear to me that China has been exporting at least disinflation or slower inflation, and in some cases, deflation. There's a lot of news in the papers today about lithium prices, which are down 80%. And so you're right, they're exporting either disinflation or deflation. But also, if you go back to the George Soros reflexivity, which is that when something right. can't go on forever, it doesn't. And there's a chance that we've reached that point in China this week. with their cut in the triple R. And so the stock market right. there has rallied almost 10%. And this morning, the price of oil, the WTI in the U.S., is up to about $46. It was in the low 40s. Anyway.
So, Ed, I mean, you know, that kind of brings up a good point. I want to follow on Tom's question here. If we've got China slower than people anticipated, if we've got Europe weaker than people would like to see, particularly Germany, I mean, boy, you see the challenges there. Can the U.S. be that decoupled from the rest of the world in being a growth marketplace when so much of the rest of the world is, you know, if not in recession, darn close to it?
No. You know, Alan Greenspan, who enjoyed being inscrutable, but he also coined some pretty good thoughts, one of which in the late 90s was that the U.S. cannot be an oasis of prosperity. And that's what we have now. I think you're correctly pointing that out. And the data this morning out of Europe is weak. We also survey companies that have sales in weak in Europe. Mm-hmm. And that survey is about 32. The U.S. comparable survey is 49, to put right. it in perspective. And then over in China, our survey there is about 32. And so that gives the world economy, you know, a soft inclination. But like I mentioned this morning, because I live up right on the edge, the news out of China is a little bit better. I mentioned oil prices have bounced up a little bit, and their stock market has bounced up a little bit. So I can't tell if this triple R cut this week is the beginning of a real serious effort. They've had some false starts before, but it's a move in the right direction, and we'll see if it bears fruit.
Ed Hyman, I want you to talk about one of the great fears. You harken back to the 90s, and I'd even take it back to Mr. Isaacs in the 80s as well. In the zeitgeist of American Global Wall Street, there is a real fear of our small banks linked in to bad real estate loans. Is it a legitimate fear? Is this something that we need to study, or is it noise?
It's not noise. So every week on Friday afternoon, I get the government data on bank deposits, and they are going down. They're down about 2 or 3%. Which is the biggest drop since the 1930s, which is a sobering point by itself. So that gets back, you know, the bank deposits are essentially the money supply. It's 85% of the money supply. So you got to watch it. This is my 13th Fed tightening cycle. So I'm a gnarled veteran of these cycles. And every single one of them has had financial shocks or crises. And so the one we had last year, was SVB and the small banks having a deposit run on their deposits. That was a shock crisis. And I think we're probably going to get another one before this is over.
Okay. And I got one last thought here before we let you go. And this is with great respect for what folks, I can't say enough. And I understand Sweeney and McKee and Lisa are too young for this, but we used to actually get printed research reports, and you would wait on Tuesday to get the C.J. Lawrence Green Book, and it would come out. It was Ed Hyman, and then a guy named Ed Yardeni picked it up. Ed Hyman, do you have the Yardeni optimism that corporations will adapt, that we will see a 10, a 15, a 20% lift in the Yardeni duration of stock prosperity in America, getting out to what, Dow 40,000, Dow 45,000? Do you share that optimism with the gentleman from Yale University?
I don't, but I like Ed Yardeni a lot. And I follow his work, I follow his thinking. I respect him. When I left C.J. Lawrence, he replaced me. I'm happy. So, you know, the world goes around. But I really do think about what he's thinking about. And it goes back to, you know, some thoughts about the 1930s. As I mentioned, I think monetary tightening is extremely strong right now, monetary tightening. And that keeps me away. At the moment, my view and our house view is that the market's going up. And that's because inflation's coming down, the Fed's on pause, and the economy's still fine. But I would guess, and Paul, you were needling me a little bit there on the recession story, but I think the economy will get weaker, earnings will go down,
right,
and then it'll be a fight between declining earnings and the Fed cutting interest rates.
Ed Hyman, thank you so much.
Yes.
With Evercore ISI, I can't say enough about how he changed modern market economics. I put him and Alan Greenspan together. They simply changed how we digest the game day by day. Ed Hyman, thank you on YouTube, on CarPlay.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority, by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is a joy, and Paul, I just did this on LinkedIn and Twitter, which is it's borderline entertainment about entertainment. Lucas Shaw pulls out the typewriter Saturday evening, 8
yep.
p.m., and you don't know this, but he's doing this at the bar of the Sunset Tower
nice.
Hotel.
Nice.
Now, it's exclusive. I've sat there with a number of fancy people around. I mean, the owner, Jeff Klein,
yep.
knows that Lucas Shaw is a player. I love what Jeff Klein says about the Sunset Tower Grill. He says, it's where a duchess can be a devil, a celebrity like Lucas Shaw can dine with his family one night and his mistress the next.
I
mean, that's
place.
The L.A. that Lucas Shaw covers here. Have you ever been in the Sunset Grill with fancy people fancy drinks?
I was there.
What
like
happens?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. Okay. You didn't fall in the swimming pool, right?
I did not fall in the swimming
okay,
pool.
Okay. What happens now with Paul Sweeney and Lucas Shaw's Hollywood blown up? What are the conversation at Jeff Klein's Grill?
The conversation, depending on what company you work for, but at a lot of them is, will my company still be around or at least still be independent in 6 to 12 months, I would say. So you've got Paramount, which has been the subject of kind of near constant deal speculation for several months, and it's now starting to feel pretty real. You've got Warner Brothers Discovery, led by David Zaslav, who seems like he realizes his company is still not big enough, or feels his company is still not big enough, and wants to merge with something else. You've got Comcast sitting on the sidelines figuring if it wants to do something. You've got Disney and Bob Iger making cuts and also talking about different deals. So there's
right.
a lot going on.
I got 8 questions. I got to resell this, folks. We're commercial free this entire hour. We go from Edward Hyman and then
wow.
step it up to Lucas Shaw. I mean, it's pretty good here. And we're on CarPlay
good.
On YouTube as well. Paul Sweeney with 14 questions for Lucas Shaw.
And Lucas Shaw covers all the media entertainment for Bloomberg News out of our stylish LA office, I will mention. Lucas, let's start with Paramount Global. We have to go to Sherry Redstone, the daughter of one of the greatest media moguls, I think, over the last 50 years, Sumner Redstone. She's the controlled shareholder. What do you think she's thinking here? Why would she consider now, after all these years, maybe thinking about selling the company?
I think there are two primary reasons. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about Paramount over the years. Most of it not real. There weren't she did not seem open to selling. But I think now she's looking at her business, and it is more challenged than it's ever been. And it doesn't seem like there's an obvious or even a particularly difficult solution. You know, they own all these cable networks that are shrinking by the day. Their streaming service is the fifth, sixth best streaming service, and it loses a bunch of money. So that's one issue. You know, they've had to cut the dividend that gets paid to the holding company of her family, which is sort of like its piggy bank. The other one that I've been told by people close to her was that she was pretty seriously, she's Jewish, and she was very affected by what happened in October.
Really?
And is starting to devote more of her time and attention to matters related to that and education. And so you combine the fact that the family empire is sort of crumbling, and she now has something else that she figured she could spend her time and money on. And I think that combination means that she's now ready to part with it.
Well, the reporting today, David Ellison, the son of Larry Ellison of Oracle, maybe he's considered. What do we know about David Ellison and how legit he might be as a potential buyer?
Look, he is very impressive, I will say. He entered, you had these two Ellison kids, David Ellison and Megan Ellison, enter Hollywood 10, 15 years ago. And I think a lot of people looked at them with suspicion.
Yeah.
You know, you trust fund kids, their dad's one of the richest guys in the world. They just want to play with daddy's money and make movies. Megan Ellison went one direction. She made all these art house movies with high-end directors. The product creatively was great. Commercially, it was a disaster.
Okay.
David Ellison basically went in the opposite direction. He liked making big blockbuster movies, and so he went and had a deal with Paramount where he co-financed, co-produced their biggest movies, Star Trek and Mission Impossible, and has done pretty well and continues to expand his business. Now, is he the person who's going to have a solution for Paramount? That's hard for me to say because I'm not sure anyone does. But it would be foolish to bet against him because he's proven to be a pretty good operator in the last 15 years.
Down Sunset Boulevard is one of my favorite leather chairs in America. It's the Cuban Seed Cigar Company, which has literally been there in the middle of World War II. It's a great story of family that rolls their own cigars. It's just a glorious, glorious family. Every time I sit there, Lucas, somebody fancy walks in. So two guys are sitting there right now. What are they saying about David Zaslav? We've seen New York media write that this guy, after everything with Warner Brothers Discovery, is still an outsider. With a stock performance, is Mr. Zaslav ever more an outsider?
I have to start by asking, what is your favorite or preferred type of cigar?
Well, what I go for is not treated. I mean, you know, like Lisa's trying to get me on the fancy cherry oaked ones and all that. No. So my favorite run-of-the-mill cigar is a Padron 1964. It's a little lighter than the 1926. So I go with that. But you're at Cuban Seed. I mean, one day on there, Cy Stallone walks in. I mean, what is that about? You know, I didn't say Mr. Stallone, you know, all that. Lisa would have gone mental. Is the Rock walked in there once. We were here yesterday.
Boy.
Lisa's going nuts about The Rock. Let's rip up the script right now.
Yes.
How big is The Rock in L.A. right now with his deal with Netflix?
His deal with Endeavor. Or does he have a deal with Netflix that I missed?
Help me here. Lisa, help me.
He's now part of the board for TKO.
Yes,
group.
which is affiliated with Endeavor. He's one of the. Well, I'll do The Rock briefly, and then we can go to Zaslav. The Rock is one of the biggest movie stars in the world. His dependability, I think, in the last couple of years has actually been a little shakier than it was before. But he's huge star, huge following. Right. And then obviously because of his history with the WWE, joining the board at TKO makes a lot of sense.
He said bad things about do you need Kleenex?
I do.
Do you need Kleenex? I'll throw it over there. There's a Kleenex for Lisa. Okay, go to Zaslav now. This is serious. I mean, with CNN and all that, where does Mr. Zaslav fit in for 2024?
Look, he's had his bumps as the CEO of that company. A lot of them, I think, have been about sort of how he's executed and the selling of those strategies have they have pissed off a lot of people in Hollywood because of the way that he's treated certain filmmakers and certain ideas. But his company faces basically the same challenges as Sherry Redstone and Paramount. They're just maybe twice as big. And the two things that I do think they have going for them are their TV studio is much larger and more productive, and so they can keep selling stuff. And they have a streaming service that is better than Paramount Plus.
Mike, just emailed in. It's in my headphones. Mike says, forget the Hollywood talk, do the market. So hold on, Lucas.
Okay.
Paul Sweeney's got a bunch of questions. Is Ira Jersey told you the GDP price index really something? And yields come in. Thank you, Rich Truman, for that. The two-year yield in, a solid 2 basis points. 10-year in, a big 3 basis points. So there is a yield move off the data. And you see it in the equity markets with a lift here. We'll get to the entertainment stocks in a moment, but it's ugly. On CarPlay, on YouTube, Lucas Shaw with us. I can't say enough about screen time. Paul?
Hey, Lucas, you and your team, you're in Hollywood. You're based in L.A. You really got your finger on the pulse of what's happening in that town. I got to believe, as you mentioned earlier, people got to be just really scared about the future of their business. You know, as an investor, I don't think I could invest in that business right now. And I've been investing in media for 35 years. I can't do it right now because I have no idea where the business is going. What's the feeling in Los Angeles when you talk to the writers, the directors, the people that are really involved in this business? Are they really scared about the future of media?
Well, I'd say the feelings are mixed because you have to remember that when you're talking about writers and actors and directors, a lot of them spent 2023 out of work, right?
Yeah,
there were two prolonged labor stoppages. The writers went on strike, followed by the actors. And so I think some people entered this year slightly hopeful because they at least could get back to work. Now, I think those paying attention to the macro story, to kind of to what you said, are a little more concerned because they're seeing almost every company, if not cutting back, kind of leveling off the spend. And you have to think about the fact that over the last 8-10 years, there's been this sort of unprecedented surge in the amount of stuff being made.
Yep.
Just, you know, the number of TV shows from like 200 to 600, and that's leveling off. I think people think that's going to go down. This business is not collapsing. You know, you talk about investing. The, you know, people who've invested in Netflix have done pretty well over the last couple of years, certainly over the last 10. But what we don't know is which companies are going to benefit or kind of survive the shakeout. And there's a little bit of market distortion because you've got a couple of players in Apple and Amazon who can spend a lot of money without really worrying about how profitable their entertainment businesses are.
That's true. That's really tough. How about our good friends at Disney? That's one of the stories that I think people have a lot of interest in. Bob Iger coming back. What's the call there on Disney? What's the feeling in Los Angeles about the future of this company? Maybe the future of Bob Iger and the management team there.
Well, Disney provokes a lot of uncertainty. You know, Iger comes back and he had been one of the great media CEOs, really one of the great CEOs of the 21st century.
Yeah.
And they thought that he was going to steady the company. Then he goes about and fires a bunch of people and starts talking about what he's going to sell, what he's not going to sell, sort of almost seems to be flirting with potential suitors through the press to figure out what's possible. But the real problem for Iger and Disney is that they had been the most dependable studio in the town. You know, every movie they made seemed to become a big hit. When they launched their streaming service, they did it perfectly with The Mandalorian, the right Star Wars show. And yet, all at the same time, Lucasfilm, which makes Star Wars, Pixar, Disney Animation, and the Disney live action movies seem to have hit a wall.
Yep.
And it's hard to know what to do about that. And it takes a few years to turn it around.
We got to be positive here with Lucas.
Sure.
Paul Sweeney and Lucas here, it's like the world's coming to an end in Hollywood. I showed Afterthought the other day, Greg Peck in 12 O'Clock High. And it's just, she fell apart. I mean, come on, it's real war footage, 1950s. Hanks and Spielberg, in 2 days, folks, Apple TV, you're going to see Masters of the Air. Lucas, this is a bet by the old school on the new technology through Apple TV and a 10-year soap opera of getting this thing made. I've been looking at the British reviews, The Guardian, BBC, and that, which are massively rave. What's the buzz on screen time about the Hank Spielberg vehicle on World War II?
Well, in general, the buzz around Apple original programming is strong. You know, they have come in and invested in really high caliber filmmakers and movie stars to make their TV shows pop and stand out. Because you have to remember, there's nothing else to watch on Apple TV Plus but their original programming. Now, not to go negative, the challenge for Apple is that nobody watches their stuff outside of like LA and New York. Because the audio, well, partially because they don't have that library. And so it's harder for people to, people don't make it a habit of going into that
service. So then why don't they buy Paramount and put them out of their misery?
Because Apple doesn't like to do things like that. They don't do big M&A. They don't seem interested in a library. But the shows that they make are really good. That's why, you know, they just got the, second, third most Oscar nominations of any studio, largely because of the Scorsese movie, but also the Ridley Scott movie. They've got a really impressive lineup of movies coming out later this year. And the thing to remember, I mean, all of these companies are still making great product.
I'm going to bring this over to Paul Sweeney's world. What did Masters of the Air cost?
I haven't seen what the estimates are, but I would imagine a heck of a lot of money.
A heck of a lot of money. See, they just CFA level four right there. Paul, come on. It costs $100 million plus, more money than God, financed for low rates, Spielberg and Hanks.
Yep.
Paul Sweeney, they're doing that on what, $9.99 a month?
Yeah. Like a $10 billion. Apple's got $10 billion of free cash flow, so to Lucas's point, they can invest whatever they want. Let's go to one of the really positive stories coming out of Hollywood or just entertainment business, that of being Netflix. They've obviously revolutionized the television business, disrupted it like no other business. They said forever and ever and ever, we're not going to do live events. We're not going to do sports. Who needs that kind of stuff? Then they do this deal with WWE. Did that change some minds in Hollywood? Are people kind of saying, maybe they will consider live events, maybe make a move for live sports, that kind of thing?
I did a poll of some top entertainment industry executives at the end of last year, and I asked them how many years they thought it would be before Netflix got into live sports, live events. And the first of all, I'd say 80 to 90% of people said that they would, as opposed to never. And of those, most people thought it would be in the next 3 years. I think there was this, you know, Netflix has said they wouldn't do a lot of things. They said they wouldn't do advertising. Right. Now they're doing advertising. They said they wouldn't abandon binge viewing or binge releases, which they haven't, but they now space out some of their seasons, drop them in two parts. And so I think over time, Netflix has embraced certain traditional behaviors because it turns out that you don't have to reinvent everything in the playbook. And once you go into an advertising supported service, having a live event that can command a lot of viewers, like wrestling, is good. Now, whether they're going to go in and bid a couple billion dollars a year for NBA rights, that I'm still a little skeptical of, but I'm less skeptical of it than I was before.
1 minute. Thank you so much for joining us off of Tokyo and Sundance and the rest of it. The glory, he's got the rock star life of us, Lucas Shaw, with Screen Time.
That's how they
the
do it.
The death of the Los Angeles Times. I get
I wasn't sure where you were going with that.
Nobody ever knows. Lucas, Lisa never knows where I'm going. I mean, but come on. I grew up where the Los Angeles Times mattered.
Times Mirror.
Is it dying?
Look, my dad worked there for almost 40 years. It's one of the saddest things I could see. I don't know that it's dying, but it's in really, 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 really bad shape. You know, it was one of these newspapers that got bought by a billionaire who seemed to want to do the right thing.
But didn't. I can't get it.
And his daughter had certain ideas about it, but they've just never figured out what the editorial and business strategy is to make it a sustainable paper, which is insane to me because it's the only real newspaper in the second biggest city in the country. It's becoming kind of the only real newspaper in California, which is home to many people. And you'd think you could figure it out, and it baffles me.
This is great. Lucas and I, Paul, you can join us here. We can bring Lisa as well. You know, I mean, I could see us at the Sunset Grill where a duchess can be a devil and a celebrity like Lucas Shaw can dine with his family one night and his mistress the next. Lisa, this is inappropriate. That's why Lucas Shaw's here.
Exactly.
Thank you so much. With Screen Time, I put it out on Twitter and LinkedIn. Can't say enough. This guy works on all the entertainment that we consume. Joining us now on the train wreck is Garrett Nelson, CFRA Research Senior Equity Analyst. Garrett, help me here on Tesla. How bad was the conference call?
Well, our point is that this is a stock that more than doubled last year. So we think what you're seeing in terms of this profit taking is healthy price action. We didn't think the call was that bad. We think the stock is selling off because investors are alarmed about the guidance for slowing auto shipment growth in 2024, but that was already baked into everyone's estimates. So it was understood that they were not going to continue to grow their auto deliveries by 38% this year like they did last year.
Are people only buying Teslas? The cliche out there, and we go to Lisa Mateo on this because she's like EV queen. But the basic idea I have is EVs are a failure in America except Tesla. And so the units are pretty good because that's the only car people are buying. Is that right?
That's pretty much accurate. If you look, Tesla's market share in the U.S. was 55% of the U.S. EV market last year. Where the real oversaturation is the other 45%. All the non-Tesla EVs are just not selling well. They're sitting on dealer lots. Inventories in December were 117 days supply for EVs overall, wow. Which is way above the historic average for automobiles of 60 days. So there's a huge inventory glut of non-Tesla EVs.
So, Garrett, if I'm a bull, if I have a buy rating, and I think it's a 50 PE is based upon my target, I have to be bullish about EVs in general, don't I? It's not just a Tesla call. I have to be a bull on EVs in North America, don't I?
Not necessarily. You have to be bullish, I think, on Tesla.
Okay.
We're actually fairly bullish on the EV, fairly bearish on the EV market overall. In terms of adoption rates are much slower than we thought we would see a few years ago. If you look, 7.6% of all new vehicle sales last year were EVs. We think a lot of automakers were hoping that those percentages would be above 10% at that point. So, but there's no question, there's a lot of demand for Tesla EVs. We know the Cybertruck reservation count is somewhere north of 2 million units.
Wow.
Far and away the highest of any vehicle model in the U.S. And then last night they confirmed these rumors of this next-gen mass-market EV where first production could come as soon as mid next year.
So, I mean, Garrett, I just bought a new car, and I did at the car I was looking, the automobile I was looking at, I did look at the EV version, but the premium to go EV over ICE was so big. And me, I could care less about EVs in the environment. I'll do it another way. But I mean, what do you do here? I mean, you have to bring the price down, don't you? Is that even viable for this industry over the next several years?
So if you look over the last year, the price has come down. You look at the EV price premium in December, it was only 4%. A year earlier, it was over 30%. So 2023 was a year in which the EV price premium really collapsed. And we think that we're getting near an inflection point where EVs are going to, well, they're already very close to price parity with internal combustion engine vehicles, and that's going to be a big positive that's going to stimulate demand.
Garrett, let's talk about Mr. Musk. And I do this with great respect, folks, for his technological innovation and all that he's done. You know, forget about the notoriety and all the idiocy. Garrett, is he devoting chairman or CEO energy to Tesla?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's
my only good one of the day, so go with it, Garrett. That's it. Mateo has all the good ones.
He's spread very thin across SpaceX, Tesla, and all of his other businesses. Now X, formerly Twitter. So there's no question he's spread thin. But what's become clear, if you look back, you know, the investor days over the last 2 or 3 years, there's a very deep bench at Tesla. While he is the face of the company, the face of the brand, behind him is a very strong, capable team of brilliant engineers.
Bloomberg Business Flash. This is from our European travel correspondent, Charles Pellet. Europe on $5 a day. Paris, Garrett Nelson, bans big, ugly American cars, and they lead with the Cybertruck. How's the Cybertruck doing? Besides, I'm not going to see it on Rue Dauphine in Paris.
Well, the Tesla faces a high-class problem with the Cybertruck. We know the reservation count is off the charts. The problem with this is the manufacturing methods are much more difficult than the Model Y or the Model 3. So, and Musk himself has admitted this, it's going to be very difficult to ramp production of the Cybertruck. It's not going to look anything like the ramp up of the Model 3 or the Model Y that we've seen in past years. So, the challenge for them is really how quickly can they ramp up and get that vehicle in the hands of reservation holders.
So, you know, Garrett, I looked at the Ford. I actually drove the Ford F-150 Lightning, which was an awesome vehicle. But I was actually surprised that Ford cut back the production there. So what does that tell you about the EV space? Or is that a Ford specific issue?
Yeah, we think, again, that goes back to the issue with non-Tesla EVs. The demand just isn't there. And so you're seeing automakers, you're seeing GM, Ford, and others start to cut back on those models in favor of gas-powered models, which are selling much better. In Ford's case, the Bronco.
I've got to leave it there. Garrett Nelson, thanks for the brief there on Tesla.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Boring is good for Rabobank. Let's get right to it. Jane Foley joins us at Rabobank in London. When it's this quiet, Jane, the shop does well, right? Because people are hedging commercial transactions. You're taking in a fee. I mean, it must be glorious now that foreign exchange is so boring.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I've met clients before who said, oh, you know what, we didn't bother hedging last year because the foreign exchange was flat. And now this year, we wished we had because it's really eaten into our profits. And sometimes they come to us when the door is already, right. You know, the horse is already bolted. But so not necessarily good. But, you know, I would say that there's still lots to be considering in the foreign exchange world. We've seen the euro move a little bit this afternoon on the back of the Lagarde press conference. And, of course, this week we've seen the yen moving too as a market begins right. to get a bit more excited about an earlier possible interest rate hike, maybe soon as March.
Let me go there so we can make some money. Folks, for those of you on Global Wall Street that don't look at euro-yen, euro-yen is my litmus paper. A weak yen is a bigger number, 155, 160, hit 161 last week. What is the tension for the institutions of Japan with euro-yen, ever weaker yen, stronger euro?
Well, again, it depends who you are in Japan. So, you know, the big exporters, the Toyotas, et cetera, of this world, well, they tend to do pretty well when the yen is pretty weak, you know, and then they see demand picking up. And that's pretty good for them because even if inflation is high in Japan and has been relatively high in the last couple of years, they can just export that through their pricings. But it's the domestic companies who, or at least the companies with the domestic audience, domestic consumer, facing consumer, they're the ones that in the last couple of years have been a little bit uncomfortable because they've seen, you know, higher commodity prices, which of course have come off those peaks right now, but they cannot, or they find it much more difficult to pass on the pricing and into a country where people have to, until very recently, been reluctant to accept that prices ever go up.
Right.
Hey, Jane, we did hear from the European Central Bank today, Christine Lagarde, standing by comments on a, quote, likely summer rate cut. How does that kind of inform your view of some of the European currencies?
You know, that speech when she talked about the likely summer rate cut was made last week to, you know, one of your colleagues in Davos. And I think there was a little bit of, you know, the headlines, you know, take away some of the context of that. I don't think, you know, she was saying, yes, we'll be cutting interest rates in June. I just think she was being a little bit more vague, really, about that about that timing. But, you know, I think what's interesting today, particularly from today's comments, or at least from the market reaction, because the market reaction has seen this as being fairly dovish. And I think the reason for that is that there wasn't a forceful pushback against market pricing. And market pricing, as we know, has been pricing in, you know, a couple of interest rate cuts, to say, in a six-month view. Many economists are far more doubtful of that. But if she could have used that opportunity to push back on mm-hmm. that, and she didn't. And I think, therefore, the market thought, well, you know, she's not pushing back on us. Maybe the ECB could go earlier. So I think that's been the takeaway today. But what she did say is that they are data focused.
Yep.
And I don't think any decision yet has been made by them.
Jane, the British pound, sterling here, you've got a note out saying, hey, politics matter here and the debt of the UK matters. Talk to us about kind of your views on the pound sterling.
Well, you know, this comes on the back of some data we had earlier in the week that said actually in December, public financing figures were better than expected, which they were. And of course, that feeds into Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, who's already indicated, in fact, he was at Davos last week saying this, that he will be cutting taxes. Now, obviously, that's is designed to help the Tory party into the election, which is expected at the end of the year. But the Tory party are so far behind Labour, you know, good old 20 points or so behind Labour, that it probably won't make too much difference. But the issue with the fiscal situation, and we had, you know, another think tank this morning saying that the new government, whoever wins the election, will be faced the worst fiscal position that a new government has taken in 70 years. And that, I think, is quite interesting, because you recall a couple of years ago we had the Liz Truss fiasco. The gilt market basically said, no, you know, we're not going to tolerate unfunded spending. And with that memory, I think whoever takes over the chancellorship in after this election, you know, will have to take upon fiscal discipline, which actually might mean that from the markets, this is a boring election.
Jane, thank you. Jane Foley with an FX update. I've been remiss in not doing enough on foreign exchange here. We'll promise to do more of that. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.